that Ben would have returned my call, that he were here beside me right now, a half step ahead as we reach out our hands and make introductions with the grizzly detective. But he's not. Ben isn't here, and so I have to make do. While a knight in shining armor is great, this time I might have to save my own day. I sit beside the detective on the cold wooden bench. I tell him my name, and he tells me his, though of course I already know. The space is not entirely vacant. There are other people here. It is, after all, Chicago. But the people are few. And they're all caught up in their own thing, taking photos of the big buildings, feeding the pigeons French fries, arguing with children. No one looks at the detective and me. Detective Robert Davies is losing his hair. Male pattern baldness, I believe they call it. He's got a receding hairline. But his hair is brown, no gray anywhere, so I bet he's happy about that. Must be hard to get old. He takes out a tiny notebook.
How long has Esther been missing?
He asks, and I tell him, since Sunday. But then I amend, feeling somehow more guilty for this admission, for the fact that it's now been 5 days since I've seen Esther with my own two eyes. Maybe Saturday night. And at that, my gaze falls to my hands, to a blue chalcedony ring on my right hand, an oval stone on a sterling silver band. I can't bring myself to look the detective in the eye. Her words return to me, Esther's words. I'd be a killjoy, Quinn. Go without me. You'll have more fun. The Martini Bar on Balmoral, its grand opening. That's what I remember. I also remember Esther sitting alone on the apartment sofa, wrapped up in pajamas and a comfy plissé blanket in a seafoam green. The last time I laid eyes on my friend.
We've spoken before,
he tells me knowingly when I hesitate for a split second, not quite sure I want to admit to Esther's disappearance out the fire escape. His eyes are sharp, like an eagle or a hawk. There are lines on his forehead, a prominent schnoz. I'd bet my life he doesn't smile, not once, not ever.
You and I,
he says again.
We've spoken before.
And I say I know. Of course I know. It was just this morning. And I remind him of our phone call, a soul 2 hours ago, as I stood in my apartment making arrangements for this little tete-a-tete in the park. I'm pretty sure a small huff emerges from me, or at the very least an eye roll. Certainly he can't be that incompetent that he doesn't remember our conversation this morning. And at that, great Scott, he smiles. I pray this isn't a harbinger of what's to come.
We've spoken before today, Quinn,
he tells me derisively. And it's then that I remember the first thought I had when I pressed end on my cell phone following our call. I've heard that voice before. But when? I try to connect the dots, to place his voice somewhere else, to match this voice to another voice, and it's then that it comes to me, these words.
It's a confidential matter. We had an appointment this afternoon. She didn't show.
The man on Esther's phone Sunday afternoon when I found it forgotten in the pocket of that red hoodie. Detective Robert Davies was the man on the other end of the line. The one who refused to leave a message. I'll call back, he'd said. But he didn't call back. Not then, anyway. Not until today, on account of my missing persons report. But he didn't call Esther. This time he called me. You called Esther the other day, I say. You were supposed to meet. You had an appointment. The detective nods his head.
She didn't show,
he says. And I solemnly admit. By then she was already gone. Why were you planning to meet? I ask. But I'm guessing he won't tell me this on account of its confidentiality. It's a confidential matter. But to my surprise, he does, but only after I tell him what I know. I lay it all on the line this time. I tell him everything. The disappearance out the fire escape, the strange notes, the death of Kelsey Bellamy. And then I show Esther's phone to the detective, the threatening message still here on the display screen. Payback's a bitch. He seems rapt by this, for a fleeting bit. He holds it up close to his eyes so he can see the words more clearly. Seems he's losing his vision, too. Presbyopia, it's called. I've seen the commercials for progressive lenses, and again I'm stricken by the fact that aging must stink. Not that I would know. Esther sent that to me, I say. He looks at me questionably.
What would make you say that? Why do you think Esther sent this text to her own phone?
This is something I never paused to consider. Why would Esther send this text to her own phone? Why not mine? I'm not sure, I say. Maybe she knows I have her phone. Or, I begin, but then stop quickly and shrug it off. I don't know why Esther would have sent that text to her own phone. She killed her last roommate. I reveal quietly instead, the words themselves a betrayal to Esther. I whisper the words so that Esther can't hear. Kelsey Bellamy, I say, and then, she's trying to kill me too. I tell him about the shredded photograph. The candid shot of me walking down the street in my plum sweater, the mark of a red pen slicing my throat in two. A threat.
Esther isn't trying to kill you, is what he says to me.
He says it like he's sure, like in his mind there's no doubt about it, like he knows.
What do you mean? I ask, and how do you know?
And then he goes on to explain. Detective Davies tells me that he first met Esther a year or so ago when he was investigating the death of Kelsey Bellamy. It was more or less an open and shut case, he says. The girl had food allergies, which I know. She ate something she was allergic to. She couldn't get to her medicine in time. Hundreds of people die from anaphylaxis each year. It's not that common, and yet it happens. That's what the detective tells me. Negligence might have played a part in Kelsey's death, yes, and at the time Esther took a great deal of blame.
People pointed fingers, he says. People always want to point fingers. They need someone to blame.
But once Kelsey's death was ruled an accident, life went on for Esther and for Detective Davies. There was no doubt in his mind that Esther hadn't purposefully tried to tamper with Kelsey's meal.
I've seen a lot of liars before,
he tells me.
But Esther wasn't one of them. She passed a lie detector test with flying colors. She cooperated with the investigation. She was an exemplary witness and clearly contrite. She felt terrible about what had happened to Kelsey. She owned up to it right away, the mix-up with the flower, and was never defensive. I can't say as much about most witnesses, and certainly not the guilty ones.
He pauses for a breath and then continues.
Esther called me Saturday night out of the blue. We hadn't spoken in months, nearly a year. But she had something to show me,
he says, adding on,
she seemed spooked.
And there's such conviction in his voice, I find myself holding my breath, forgetting to breathe. Esther was spooked. But why? The very thought of this makes me want to cry. Esther was sad. Esther was scared. And neither time did I know. Why didn't I know? What kind of friend am I?
She didn't say much on the phone. She wanted to tell me in person. She'd received something, a note. I can only assume it had to do with Miss Bellamy,
he says. My heartbeat accelerates and, tucked up into the sleeves of the aqua sweater, my hands begin to sweat.
When did she call you? I ask. Saturday night, 9 o'clock or so, he says.
9 o'clock. Shortly after I left for that stupid karaoke bar, leaving Esther behind in her pajamas and a blanket. Did Esther purposefully wait until I'd left to call the detective? Was she even sick? Esther had received a note, I wonder. But no. I consider the notes to my dearest. Esther wrote those notes. He must be mistaken. The signature line most clearly reads, "All my love, E.V. Esther Vaughn." She's signed her name to the letters. They're hers, aren't they? Is it possible that Esther is somehow my dearest? I'm a tad bit skeptical, to say the least. I have the notes, I tell Detective Davies then, reaching into my purse and thrusting the two typewritten notes into his hand. I brought them with me. I've been carrying them around with me in my purse because I couldn't think of another safe place to leave them. But I've read them, of course, many times. And neither says a thing about Kelsey Bellamy. As Detective Davies's eyes scan the notes, he too seems unimpressed, though he asks if he can keep them anyway. I nod my head and watch as he slips the notes carefully into some sort of evidence pouch, where later I imagine they'll be dusted for fingerprints, and some sort of forensic analyst will try and find the make and model of the typewriter on which the notes were typed. The notes are completely madcap, don't get me wrong. They are. But inside, there's no grand confession. No mention of Kelsey Bellamy. Somehow he's got it all wrong. He must have misunderstood what Esther said, or maybe she was lying, or in the very least stretching the truth. Maybe Esther was trying to mislead the detective. But why?
There was nothing else? The detective asks, and I say no. There must be more, he says, but I assure him there's not.
The look that crosses his face makes me believe I've failed again. In some way, I've let him down. Or maybe I've just let Esther down. Right now, it's hard to say for sure.
But what about the photograph, I ask?
Of me. The one Esther put in the paper shredder. My face with a slit across the throat. That was clearly a threat. She wants me dead.
Or...
suggests Detective Davies as I feel the bile rise up inside of me like an active volcano threatening to erupt.
Maybe whoever sent Esther the letter took the photo of you too. Maybe that's who wants you dead.
Alex. The ground looks hard. Not frozen solid, but hard. The top layer, the sod, seems the hardest to get through as she begins digging into the cold morning earth with her gardening spade, pressing on the steel with the sole of a suede boot. The sod binds together, a million sheaths of grass, clinging together, refusing to let her through. It's hard work, but Pearl forces her way in, gouging out the land bit by bit. I watch in awe as she thrusts the cold, hard earth up in the blade of the shovel, tossing it into a pile behind her slender frame. As she does, she begins to sweat, a cold sweat that congeals on her skin and makes her shiver, and as I watch from a distance, she removes her coat first, followed by the hat, tossing them both onto the dew-covered lawn, and I'm reminded of the day at the lake. Pearl undressing bit by bit, and then walking into the frigid water. As the steel blade hits topsoil, the work gets easier. The earth puts up less of a fight, and the pile of dirt begins to rise. She digs and digs, and, watching her, I lose all track of time. I'm hypnotized by her movements, but also more than a little terrified. Who is this woman, and what is she doing? Why is she digging up the remains of the dead Genevieve? It feels suddenly moronic that I followed her here, suddenly stupid. Anyone with half a mind would have immediately called the police or run in the other direction, not trailed her. But now, here I am, hiding in the bushes of an all but abandoned cemetery, while some wackadoodle unearths a corpse from the ground. I squat down to the hard, cold earth, making certain that as the fog rises, I won't be seen. I don't want to even think what she'd do to me if she knew that I was here. For now, the bushes will keep my secret for me. As I watch from a distance, I dredge up what knowledge I have of the little girl who's buried in that grave. I don't know much. She was gone before I was born. But what I've heard about Genevieve is that after her death, the town's members lifted the rudimentary wooden casket from the trunk of her family's car and dropped it into this very trench in the cemetery, hastily, without the praxis of a visitation or a funeral or a procession. Instead, the body was ushered rather quickly from the car into this ditch, and nobody ever bothered to ask why. People were glad she was gone. Though she might have only been 5 years old, she was a delinquent, the kind of child that wreaked havoc on their own children and homes, tormenting kids, vandalizing property, chasing neighborhood dogs. That's what I've been told. It wasn't as though anybody wanted to see a little girl die, but still, they were glad she was gone. Her mother had her hands full, neighbors have said over the years, staring at that forsaken house, mumbling under their breaths something to the effect of, "What a damn shame." As far as I know, no one comes to visit Genevieve's grave. I can only assume her family split as soon as they abandoned that old home and buried their child in the ground. In time, Pearl's shovel begins to fill with silt and sand, followed by clay, terracotta-colored clay soil, and then, later, in the moments before the steel blade hits hollow wood, bits of broken-up rock fragments, gray like stone. It comes up in chunks, rocks that appear hard to carry. They must be heavy, and as I watch on, she takes her time, losing speed. But then I hear the sound of metal on wood, and know that she's arrived at her destination, the reason for which she'd come here. The cemetery is quiet, short of silent save for the sound of Pearl gasping for air. She fights for oxygen in the still November air. I'm guessing her throat is as dry as the bedrock. Even I am thirsty, and I'm not doing the work. She sweats in exertion, while the numb air freezes my lungs, making them ache and burn. It's cold, winter coming quickly. Too quickly. The grass around us is a faded green, a sage green, quickly losing color, becoming dormant for the winter season ahead. It's brittle to the touch and no longer burgeons out of the ground. Soon it will be covered with snow. The fog begins to rise, and as it does, the world materializes before me. Granite and marble headstones, grotesque, ill-proportioned trees, and the church, a small one-room rectangular Protestant church, white, with a stacked limestone base and clappered sides. The windows are plain, no frills, as is the entire building, an 1800 structure that's been outdone by the more modern hip churches popping up around town. I'm not even sure if anyone uses this place anymore, or if it's just for show. A dead thing, a cadaver, hollowed out like all these bodies buried beneath the ground. And then, all of a sudden, Pearl tosses the garden spade aside and stops digging. She's reached a box, a wooden box that itself is mostly decomposed. She can't lift the box, it's wedged too tightly into the earth, in the final stages of decay. It crumbles to bits in her hand, and so instead, she pushes what's left of the lid aside and peers inside. From this angle, I can't see inside Genevieve's grave, but I watch for Pearl's reaction. What I see is a look of smug satisfaction, as if she was hoping to prove something to the world, and that's exactly what she did. She puts her hands on her hips. She smiles. She leaves the garden spade where it is, the mound of dirt piled sky high, the gravesite exposed so that all of the world can see. And then she wipes her sweaty brow with the back of a sleeve, picks up her coat and her hat to leave. But she doesn't leave. Not yet, anyway. Before she goes, her eyes rove the cemetery, from the old church to century-old headstones, to me. For a second, I'm half certain her eyes linger on my hiding place, there behind the evergreen trees and leafless bushes where I squirrel myself away and try desperately to hide. She shakes her head. She sneaks a sardonic smile. She sighs. But if she sees me, she doesn't say a thing, and then she turns and goes. I don't move right away. Instead, I wait. I wait for a long time, until the squeak of the cemetery's iron gate tells me that she's gone for good. And then I wait some more, just to be sure, and only then do I rise to my shaky feet to see what she's discovered inside that grave. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. That's what Pearl discovered. The wooden box decomposing in the hard earth is completely empty.
Quinn. Before I climb into Detective Davies' car, I insist on seeing a driver's license plus one more photo ID, vehicle registration, and proof of insurance. You never can be too careful about these things. I've seen enough legal thrillers and murder mysteries to know the cop isn't always the good guy. But in this case, I think he is. And this is why. He's not that nice. He's not that friendly.
Good enough?
Detective Robert Davies asks when he hands me the State Farm card, and I say, yeah, good enough. As I open the door and slide into an unmarked Crown Victoria that's parked in the public lot off Columbus, the car reeks of the fast food bag that lies open on the passenger seat. He scoops it up before my rear end has a chance to squash it flat and tosses it into a nearby garbage can. It's much warmer in the car without the cold and the wind, but the dreariness of the enclosed parking garage is still unsettling. Detective Davies pulls out of the narrow parking spot too quickly and down the garage ramp so that my insides continue to turn. There's a blare of his horn, warning others that he's coming through at breakneck speed as he guns the engine out onto Columbus and drives me home. As he drives, the bile again rises up inside my chest until I feel that I could vomit. My head swims with dread. My hands shake, a tremor that makes the rest of me exhausted and dizzy. My heart itself has grown wings and can fly, and there it sits in my chest, flapping its bird-like wings, threatening to soar out of my body. I think of Esther, sad and scared, and me not knowing. Was she really sad and scared? Or were these things simply a charade? Who is Esther, really? Is she even Esther, or is she Jane? The questions all but take over my mind until I can no longer see straight and I can scarcely think. Detective Davies drops me off at the front door of my apartment building. Before I can turn around to say goodbye to the detective or thank him for the ride, he speeds away quickly, with Esther's cell phone and the letters to my dearest now in his possession. He plans to see what his tech guys can extract from inside that phone. Esther's call activity and voicemails, her videos and photos. In my hand, I carry his business card, and in my head, a directive. Call if anything happens, if I find anything, if I hear from Esther, if Esther reappears. Just call. As I step from the car, I peer to the window of our unit, of Esther's and my unit, and half expect to see her standing there, staring down at me. But of course Esther isn't there. The cloudy window is bare, just the window coverings and the reflection of the other side of Farragut Avenue staring back at me. But then I see a woman standing beside the locked door, pressing a button repeatedly on the intercom panel with a hand. She waits with a toe tap for a reply that doesn't come. She stands before the door, clutching what I know to be Esther's powder blue quilted satchel in her leather-gloved hands. She's a small woman. She can't be taller than 4'10", with bulky hair that must weigh as much as the rest of her. I'd bet my life she weighs 89 pounds. Everything she wears is tight. Tight pants, tight coat, tight boots.
Can I help you?
I ask precipitately. My eyes glued to that purse. I have a sudden, overwhelming desire to reach out and clutch that purse in my hands. To hold it. That's Esther's! I want to bark out loud. And I stare at my hands, which, before me, continue to shake. I'm worried. Worried for Esther. The detective's story leaves me feeling panicked and utterly confused, even more so than I already was. This strange twist of events that takes me from mad to scared to worried. Instead of thinking that someone is after me, that Esther is after me, I'm worried for Esther. But still, there are so many questions running in my mind. What about Kelsey Bellamy? And why did Esther change her name to Jane Gerard and seek out a roommate to replace me? Why did she take $1,500 out of the ATM? This makes no sense to me, none at all.
Are you Jane?
The woman at the intercom panel begins, followed by a pause while she peers at some card in her hand and finishes with, Gerard? Are you Jane Gerard? Who is Esther Vaughn anymore, I wonder? Do I even know Esther? I shake my head quickly. I say no, that I'm not, but I'm Jane's roommate, Quinn. I say it anyway, even though I'm guessing she doesn't care about my name. She's come for Jane.
Oh, good,
she says, a great wave of relief washing over the inflated facial features, the big eyes, the big smile, the big hair. I've found this, she says as she thrusts the powder blue satchel into my hands.
In a trash can of all places.
And I take it, grateful to have something, some part of Esther, to hold. I press it close to me. I breathe in the scent of Esther that's begun to wear away and be surpassed by a grungy city smell mixed with this lady's forceful perfume, the heavy scent of jasmine and rose.
You found her purse in a garbage can?
I repeat, just to be sure. And she nods and tells me how she was about to toss in her coffee cup when she saw it lying there on top of a jillion fast food bags, the blue of the satchel catching her eye.
It's a pretty purse, she says. Much too pretty to just throw in the trash. I figured it was an oversight.
And then she says how she didn't want my roommate to worry.
I know I'd be worried if I couldn't find my purse.
That's really kind of you. I say, and it is. Of course it is, if she doesn't have some ulterior motive. Right now, I'm not sure of anything, other than the fact that I'm tired and twitchy all at the same time. My head hurts. My hands shake. If any more questions fill my mind, it might just explode. What was Esther's purse doing in a garbage can?
What garbage can?
I ask. And she points in the direction of Clark Street and says aimlessly,
Over there.
You just found it today? Right now, just a few minutes ago? But she shakes her head no.
It was a day or two ago.
And then she sighs and says,
It's been a long week. A really long week.
As if that should explain to me why it's taken her a day or two to return Esther's purse.
I live nearby, she says. It's on the way.
She tells me that Jane really should be more careful with her purse.
Carrying that much cash around.
And I know two things then. Number one, this lady riffled through Esther's purse. And secondly, when I look inside, I'm going to find $1,500 in there. Esther took the money out of the ATM, but she never used it. She didn't hire some hitman to off me. She isn't vacationing in Punta Cana, sipping a strawberry daiquiri. Where is Esther?
How do you know where we live?
I ask suddenly as we stand there on the front stoop, being enveloped by the cold autumn air.
It's on her driver's license, she tells me. I wasn't snooping,
she swears before I have a chance to ask, taking on a tone that is rueful and defensive all at the same time. She was snooping.
I was just trying to return the purse. You'll give it to her, to Jane?
this lady asks, and I say, oh, yes, of course. And then I say my goodbyes, let myself into the building, and gently close the door. Esther's and my apartment is empty when I step inside, but it smells like Esther, the scent of her cooking, the fragrance of her peony body mist. I'm struck with a wave of nostalgia. I meander to her doorway, and as I cross the threshold into Esther's refrigerator box room, I see the Dalmatian Molly floating dead at the bottom of the fish tank. I drift to the side of the tank, flipping off the tank light so that I can't see the poor dead fish on the hot pink rocks, the swoosh of the filter making it look like she's breathing when I'm certain she's not. Her body lies flaccid, turning white, a sign of rot. And as I tap on the side of the glass, she doesn't move. She's dead. Esther's fish is dead. How long has she been dead? I mouth the words, sorry, fishy. I'm not sure what I did, but I'm sure I did something wrong. I kindle a third search of the apartment, retracing every step I've already made twice. I'm growing desperate. I am desperate. There must be something more here, something I've overlooked. I look through Esther's desk and dresser drawers again. I peer inside her closet. I grope at items at random and throw them to the floor, not worrying whether or not I make a mess. I crinkle her papers, I tug the drawers right off the IKEA desk, and search for a false bottom drawer. I breathe heavily, working hard. There's nothing there. I make a mess of Esther's room. I knock her pencil cup to the ground, angry and rash. I flip through the stack of textbooks and then toss them aside one by one, where they fall to the hardwood floors, making a clamorous noise. Down below, Mrs. Budney is likely 2 seconds away from reaching for her sponge mop, but I don't care. My cell phone rings. Ben, I'm sure, finally returning my call. But I can't be slowed down. I need to find Esther. When I get to the bottom of the textbook pile, I rise to my feet and cross the room, stepping with dirty shoes on Esther's aqua throw and orange duvet, leaving dusty footprints on the fabric. Though as I do, I'm reminded of Esther's words. The dillweed goes here, and the peanut flower goes here. She wouldn't like this one bit. There's nothing here, I say to myself out loud, hands held up in defeat. I attack the living room and the kitchen with a vengeance, canvassing every drawer, every piece of mismatched furniture, behind picture frames, under the rug. I slip a hand behind the sofa cushions and search there, too. I knock on the drywall and listen for somewhere hollow, a secret hiding spot. I check inside the air return for a stash of goodies, but still, there's nothing there. Just dust and dirt and dead air. And then I have an idea, someplace I haven't yet searched. I climb on top of the kitchen cabinets and search that half-inch gap between the cabinets for a hideaway. A last-ditch attempt at finding some clue, any kind of clue, anything. I trek dirty footprints across the Formica countertop, but I don't care. But still, there's nothing there. It's from up on top of the countertop that I see it. My face red and sweaty from romping around the apartment on another fruitless mission. My heart beating quickly. My breathing heavy and uncontrolled. I'm rolling my sweater sleeves to my elbows when I catch sight of the light blue item on the floor, sitting there behind the door, right where I left it. Esther's purse. I leap from the countertop, my knees unleashing a groan, and run to the purse. How is it possible that I didn't think to look inside her purse? Turning it upside down, I toss its contents out on the floor, shaking the purse to make sure I get everything out. I set it aside, but not before zipping and unzipping the pockets, feeling the lining for a secret compartment. But the only thing that's left behind is a stick of gum. This is what I find spilled across the wooden floors of our apartment. A sewing kit. A headband, a little mirror. 3 tampons, some Altoids, Esther's light blue quilted wallet to match the light blue quilted purse, tissues, a book, and some keys. A key for the main walk-up door. A key for our apartment door, a padlock key for her storage unit. And one more typed sheet of notebook paper, folded into thirds. Addressed to my dearest, and signed, All My Love, E.V.
Alex. I'm the first one at the library when it opens for the day. I'm waiting outside at the top of a small stairway beside the white exterior columns when the librarian unlocks the door. She takes her time inserting the key in the lock and then checks her watch to be certain it's 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock and not a moment before. And then she opens the door as I breeze past, inhaling her potent hairspray, and she says to me, First one here. As if that wasn't already obvious. The fact that I was the first one here, the only one here. I mutter a quick, yup, and then hurry on to one of the computer terminals, which I haven't bothered to reserve in advance. That thought never even crossed my mind. Though I'm the only one here, the librarian tracks me down anyway, scanning my library card because, as she says, rules are rules. And I've already broken one of the 27 rules about using the library's computer terminals. I watch as she gives me a disapproving look, and then withdraws slowly from view. The only people at the library this morning are the other librarians, two older women who file carts worth of returned books. They disappear into the stacks, making the books all alphabetical and orderly, so that later people can come and muss it all up. It must drive them insane. I don't have a lot of information on which to go, but I do know that the cemetery plot where Genevieve was supposed to be buried, it's empty. I try hard to exhume from memory the stories of little 5-year-old Genevieve before she drowned in that bathtub. I wasn't born yet. I wasn't even a blip on the radar. To me, she was always a ghost. She was never a child, but rather the purported specter in the window of the home across the street, a wraith in white wafting from room to room, calling for her mother. But to others, she was a child once. I look online, and this is what I come to learn. For 34 smackers, I can request birth and death certificates from the state of Michigan's Vital Records Office, but I have to mail in a request, pay $12 more to have it expedited, and then wait. I don't have time to wait. I need the answers now. By the looks of it, the Vital Records Office may or may not even send me the information I need. Seems much of it, birth records in particular, is confidential. I don't really need Genevieve's birth certificate anyway, but her death certificate would come in handy. Something to help me understand why that casket is empty. I try another angle. I research the old house, hoping to find some sort of chain of title so I can track down the family that once lived there. Unfortunate thing is, that house has been abandoned so long it predates the world of Zillow and Trulia. The bankruptcies and foreclosures I pull up online all happened over the past couple of years. A dumpy duplex on the west side of town, a slummy home on the east, and a couple dozen more listings in between. A sign of the times, I guess. It's sad, all those people tossed out of their homes because they can't pay the bills. Pretty soon, Pops and I will be there too, standing on some busy four-way intersection, bearing cardboard signs that read, Homeless and Please Help. Feeling grateful for a buck or two. I do a quick scan for Genevieve's obituary online, hoping to find a name there for next of kin. But this is what I find. Nada. Nothing. I type in her name, followed by the word obituary, and then check twice to be sure I've spelled the words correctly. I add in the name of our tiny little town to narrow the search field, but it comes up empty. Well, not empty, per se, but it pulls up a whole bunch of trash I don't want or need. A middle-aged lady from Hamilton, Ohio. A Dominican nun from Nashville, Tennessee, dead at the age of 82. Not my Genevieve. Far as I can tell, there isn't an obituary for the little girl anywhere. Maybe it's just that it's been 20-some years since she died, or maybe it's something else. A librarian passes by, and I inquire about microfilm, hoping I might find a 2-decade-old obituary from the local paper stored there. She stands before me with a pair of bifocals dangling from a golden chain, her hair a latticework of white. She might just be the oldest person I've ever seen, and while I follow her through the library and to the microfilm reader squirreled away on the other side, passing 2 younger librarians who are no doubt faster and more technologically adept than she, and thinking this is all a colossal waste of time, it turns out she's exactly the person I need. Before we ever even make it to the microfilm machine, she asks of me, "Doing research?" And I say, "I guess you could call it that." "What kind of information are you looking for?" she asks in a helpful sort of way, not nosy, and though I hesitate, I tell her. "I'm trying to get some information on that old abandoned home out on Laurel Avenue." She stops. "What kind of information are you looking for?" she asks. I have her attention, and whether or not I want it, I don't know. But I don't have the first clue how to use a microfilm machine, and so it seems I'm going to need her help with this. "Just trying to figure out who used to live there," I say casually, like this is no big deal at all. But her answer is completely unexpected. Her voice and her demeanor change, and she looks at me like I'm either a complete idiot or I've been living under a giant sedimentary rock. "You don't need a microfilm machine for that," she says, leaning in close, the smell of her Aquanet hairspray making me want to retch. "I can tell you who used to live in that house," she says, her face just inches away so I can see the eroding teeth, the transparency of her corrugated skin, and though I'm expecting the obvious, for her to say something cryptic and obscure about the ghost of Genevieve, what she says turns my world on end and makes me question everything I once thought I knew was true.
"My dearest, you took my family away from me, and now you need to know how it feels to lose something you love. It was your fault I had to go. I want to be sure you know. They told me I was a bad girl, and that was why I couldn't stay. But we both know that's not true. It wasn't that girl's fault. You should know that. It was yours. I wish I could say that I care that she's gone, but I don't. It had to be done. It was simple, it really was. A sleight of hand. Swapping the flour while you were at work. You really must get better locks on your doors, my dear. You don't want strangers skulking around your home when you're not there. It was priceless, too, watching from my vantage point as you scooped that flour into a bowl and then fed it to your poor, unsuspecting friend. The grasping at her neck, the vomiting, the scene spiraling so quickly out of control, better than I could have ever imagined. Priceless it was, just priceless. I had to wait days for you to serve that fallacious flour, but it was well worth the wait. Well worth the wait as I watched the scene play out before me, like a performance I had scripted myself. Absolutely perfect. Unfortunate, really unfortunate, too, that I'd done away with the girl's EpiPen. That would have come in handy, wouldn't it have? It's mine now. It's your fault I came back, you know. You're the one who found me. You could have just let me be. Were it not for you, I never would have discovered that I was already dead. If only you could see me now, sweet Esther. If only you could see what I've become. I've been watching you for a while now, long enough to know your habits, your customs, your routine. I've been trailing you to work, to school, on your errands. Did you see me? Did you know that I was there? I shop where you shop, and I dress how you dress,
The same shoes, the same coat, the same hair. It wasn't hard to do. Once you were the only Esther Vaughn, but now I am Esther too. You thought that you could change your name, that you could simply disappear, that you could pay me to go. How naive. You were always her favorite. But if I'm you, then maybe she'll love me too. All my love, Evie.
Alex. All the way there, I run, my feet hammering against concrete. Though I'm completely anesthetized, I can't feel a thing. I pound on the door when I arrive, once, twice, three times, watching as the metal portal shifts in its casing from the momentum of my blow, and then again and again. She opens the door with a quizzical look on her face and stands before me, her hair pulled back from her eyes, her gentle hands folded over her abdomen. Alex, she says in a way that is both a question and a statement as I let myself inside and push the door to. You look like you've seen a ghost. Everything all right? I can't reply. There are no words. I fight to catch my breath as Ingrid slips down the foyer and into the kitchen. I listen to the sound of her footsteps as she goes, unable to speak because I can't summon the breath to speak. I double over, dropping my sweaty hands to my knees, and then, when that doesn't do it, I squat down to the floor. "Let me get you some water," Ingrid says from a distance, and before I can say a thing, I hear the sound of a kitchen faucet spilling water into the sink, the jarring noise of ice cubes plummeting from an ice maker and into a glass, the seagulls outside cawing in the distance over the sound of a truck that passes by on the abandoned street, the bobbing of tires as they yo-yo over the quarried stone. "Breathe," I tell myself. "Just breathe."
"I didn't know you were coming by today," Ingrid calls from the kitchen. "You should have told me. I would have baked something. Banana bread, or..."
And her voice carries on, but I can't hear a thing because I'm stuck on the librarian's revealing words, newsy and gossipy. "Ingrid Daub used to live there," she had said to me as I stood there, mouth agape, in the old library. "That was her house. She was a Vaughn until her husband passed, you know, and then she returned to her maiden name of Daub. It's Dutch, I think, Daub. Of course, no one really makes mention of the fact that that was Ingrid's home. Such a tragedy, what happened there. You do know about her little girl, Genevieve." The librarian had continued to jabber, but by then I'd already begun to run, realizing that for all those times Pearl sat at the cafe window, staring out across the street, it was never Dr. Giles's home she had her eye on. "I'm not hungry," is all I manage to say. I force myself upright and begin to plod into the kitchen, one foot in front of the other, one hand dragging along the wall for balance. The room spins in circles around me. There's the strongest urge to drop my head between my legs and force the blood back up into my brain. I'm lightheaded, dizzy, hardly able to breathe. But Ingrid doesn't seem to notice. I've taken less than 4 steps when the sink faucet turns off and the home becomes still, and that's when I hear the humming of a song, a morose song, a gloomy song, one I've heard Ingrid hum before. A day or two ago, I would have said I didn't know the song, but now I know. I'd recognize that lullaby anywhere. "Hush-a-bye. Don't you cry," I say, my feet standing on the line between kitchen and foyer, eyeing Ingrid as she stands before me with my glass of water in her hands. I say the words, but I don't sing them, my voice trembling, though I try to mask the rippled effect with a plumb posture, like a scared cat arching my back so that I'll look big.
You know that song? Ingrid asks of me with a pleased smile, and when I nod my head in a nebbish, submissive sort of way, exhausted, scared, and confused all at the same time, she confesses, I used to sing that to my girls when they were young. And without missing a beat, she trills aloud, Go to sleep, my little baby. And all I can see is Pearl clutching that old cloth doll to her chest, the gentle hip sway as she oscillated back and forth on the dilapidated floorboards of the old home, Ingrid's old home. Before her eyes can reveal too much, Ingrid turns her back to me and continues the low drone of a somber little lullaby she used to sing while she rocked her baby girls to sleep in her arms. At the kitchen sink, she goes through the motions of washing dishes as I stand slackly by, fighting still to catch my breath, completely unsure what to say or do. Do I say anything? Do I do anything? Do I tell Ingrid about the young woman squatting in her old, dilapidated home, the one who dug an empty casket out of Genevieve's grave and sings the same lullaby that Ingrid now sings? Or do I turn and slip away, pretending not to see what's there before my eyes, the way the dots connect, the way the pieces correlate? My folks gave me up, Pearl had said as we walked lazily around the street, but now I'm not so sure. It's midday now, the sun at its highest point in the sky, the time of day it lets itself in uninvited through windows. A cold flurry of air sweeps around the side of Ingrid's house as Ingrid and I stand in the kitchen. Over the stream of water running from the kitchen sink, I hear the front door squeak open against the weight of the wind, causing the walls of the home to whine. The door, Alex, says Ingrid with a jolt. The terror takes over her eyes. You closed the front door. You locked it. But whether I did or didn't, I don't know. As a scalloped dinner plate slips from Ingrid's wet hands and shatters into a million pieces on the kitchen floor, she screams. Esther, she says, staring over my shoulder as a low moan escapes from her throat and she beats a hasty retreat from the room across the shards of glass. The water continues to pour from the faucet, rallying together a thousand polished bubbles in the sink, which threaten to overflow. Bubbles like a bubble bath.
Oh, no,
Ingrid moans, a hand groping for her throat.
No, no, no.
I turn, and there behind me stands Pearl. Alex, it's so nice of you to come, she says, but never once does she look at me, for her eyes are lost on Ingrid.
You look just like her,
bleats Ingrid, her voice far away as if she's underwater, as if she's drowning in the kitchen sink.
You look just like her. I almost thought you were.
As she steps forward and past me, she reaches out a gutless hand to stroke the rippled locks of ombre hair. Pearl smiles the most pleased smile, like a child who's just made a brand new friend. She runs a hand along the length of the bleached out hair and offers an ostentatious curtsy so that the hemline of her checkered coat falls down to her knees.
I thought you'd like it, she says, beaming.
She always was your favorite, after all. I thought you might like me more if I reminded you of her. And then she reaches for a knife.
Quinn. When I get to the end of the note, I let out an unsuppressed cry. I can't help it. It just comes. A hand goes to my mouth with instinct. In my hands, the note shakes like a leaf in the wind. I can't stop my hand from shaking. I try to process what I've just read, to reread the note. but the words blur before me until I can no longer tell my A's from my O's or pronounce the words. The letters and words meld together before my eyes, becoming one. They flit and dart on the typed page, sneering at me. You can't catch me. But there are two takeaways that I do gather from the letter. Whoever this EV is, she killed Kelsey Bellamy. And quite possibly she's done something to hurt Esther. She's pretending to be Esther, running around town, looking and acting like Esther. Who is she? The letter makes mention of family. You took my family away from me, it says, and yet it doesn't seem like something Esther would do. Esther never talked about her family to me. If it weren't logistically impossible, I'd say she didn't have one. That she was raised by dwarves in a woodsy cottage with a thatched roof. Esther shied away when I asked questions. She snapped the lid back on the box of photographs I'd stumbled upon at the storage facility, family photographs. And when I asked who those people were in the pictures, she said to me, no one. But it was clear that they were not no one. And now I feel desperate for another look at those images, longing to see a visual of Esther's family, wondering whether or not the person who penned this note is in those photographs. I need to see. I run through the memories I've stored away in my mind, but they're nowhere. I can't dredge up the pictures. Not that Esther gave me much of a chance to see, anyway, that winter day we stood in the storage unit, looking for the Christmas tree. It was cold that day, and outside the snow came down in gobs. We stood in the cold storage facility, and, though heated, the concrete walls and floors didn't do a thing to keep us warm. I think it's over here, said Esther, meaning the Christmas tree. But instead I lifted the lid off a shoebox of photographs. I was snooping, yes. And yet it didn't feel like snooping with Esther in the very same room. I didn't think she'd mind. But she did mind. And now my heart beats fast as the room fades in and out before me, the rose sofa drifting away before drawing near. The windows are suddenly so close I can touch them, and then, just like that, they're gone. My hearing is fading in and out, too. As if I'm trapped beneath water or have a bad case of swimmer's ear. I can't hear. I never would have discovered that I was already dead. The line runs over and over again in my mind. What does it mean? I peer down at the items spread across the floor before me, and there I see Esther's keys, the three of them. Three nickel-plated brass keys on a beaded ring. A key for the main walk-up door. A key for our apartment door. A padlock key for her storage unit. A padlock key for her storage unit. I push myself up off the floor and, bringing Esther's purse along with me, start to run, thinking of one thing and one thing alone. Those pictures. I have to see those pictures. I scurry down the streets of Chicago, past shops and restaurants, a covered bus stop. A tiny space that feigns to fight off the Chicago wind but doesn't. Rather, the wind whiffles the pages of a Chicago Tribune left behind there on the bus stop bench as I run past, all the way to the storage facility on Clark Street. The storage facility itself creeps me out. Lots of doors, empty spaces, a scarcity of people. Hardly any people at all, save for a poorly paid introvert sitting behind the front desk who creeps me out too. But I can't let this get the best of me. I can't let this slow me down. Once there, I use a keycard I find inside Esther's wallet to unlock the facility doors and get inside. There's one man on duty, a man who hovers behind a pane of glass typing words into a computer screen. He doesn't raise his eyes to greet mine. It's one almond-colored roll-up door after another, all the way down a long, uninhabited corridor. The floor is some kind of polished concrete that does nothing to mask the sound of my heavy footsteps as I race down the hall, hardly able to tell one door from the next, though I've been here before. I rack my mind to remember which unit belongs to Esther. I insert the padlock key into three successive small disc locks, but it doesn't open a single one. I remind myself, I've been here before. Think, Quinn. Think. Remember. Is it this almond door or that? There must be 100 of them. 100 almond doors, all with identical locks. 1,000 of them. They all look the same to me. I transport myself in time. I try to remember the one time Esther and I were here. I retrace our steps and follow the clues. The collection of smaller closet-size units, followed by larger ones with their garage door entrances. The security camera on the wall for which Esther and I danced. I smile at the memory. Esther and I doing an Irish jig for the man at the front desk, laughing, having a ball. And then it comes to me. Unit 203. The same address as my childhood home, the one where my mother and father still live. Fate, I remember, was what Esther had called it, but I told her it was more like a stupid coincidence. I see the numbers in my mind's eye as I stood there last December, 3 feet back, watching Esther unroll the door. I find Unit 203. I insert the key into the lock when all of a sudden it opens. Presto! I'm in. I roll up the heavy door and, taking one look inside, I scream. And not just any kind of scream. A desperate, falsetto scream that grabs the attention of the store clerk, who comes stampeding through the locked metal door and into the storage unit fast. But not fast enough to catch me before I lose all cognizance of the world around me, plunging to the concrete floor with a whump. My keys and phone scatter in all directions. The muscles of my bladder contract as urine creeps down the inside of my legs, soaking my tights. My ankle twists from the sheer weight of the rest of me bearing down on the joints and bones, and it's then that I cry out in pain. My head hits the ground, bouncing up and down on the concrete like a playground ball. To that, I don't have time to react before I'm lying prostrate on the ground, just inches from Esther, close enough to touch. She wears her pajamas still. The comfy cotton pajamas she wore the last time we spoke, when she sat under the warmth of a seafoam green blanket in our living room and said to me, "I'd be a killjoy, Quinn. Go without me. You'll have more fun." That was what she'd said, and so I'd gone. I'd gone without her, and I'd had fun. But now I wonder what would have happened if I had stayed. If only I would have stayed, would I have been able to protect Esther from this fate? My eyes take in the boxes, torn open, their possessions scattered at random all around her body. Photo albums. Journals. Esther's baby books, the ones her mother meticulously put together when she was just a girl. Photos of an infant Esther, a toddler Esther, a young Esther. The photos are now all yanked from their plastic sleeves and torn to itty-bitty shreds. Who would do such a thing? And then there is Esther, of course, lying there before me,